One, two, three.
Freedom is one of our most cherished values as Unitarian Universalists. Freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom of the pulpit and the pew are all values that we have fought for, have fought to uphold. And our history includes many who engaged fully in the fight for the physical and spiritual freedom of people in slavery in this country. Our history proclaims Unitarians and Universalists who were on all sides of the question of slavery, though. We like to remember the abolitionists, like Benjamin Rush, Lydia Marie Child, and Theodore Parker. We like to remember that our Universalist forebears passed a resolution in 1790 and their convention denounced slavery as inconsistent with our faith. And in 1790, this was a very radical thing to say, right? And we so love to lift up Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, who wrote this in a sermon he delivered in 1851 in response to the Fugitive Slave Act, which required all people to assist in the capture and return of people in slavery. He wrote, "This law has brought us to the most intimate connection with the sin of slavery. I've been obliged to take my own parishioners into my house to keep them out of the clutches of the kidnapper. Yes, gentlemen, I have been obliged to do that, and then to keep my doors guarded by day as well as by night. Yes, I have had to arm myself. I have written my sermons with a pistol on my desk, loaded and ready for action, yea, with a drawn sword within reach of my hand." This legendary picture of Parker writing his sermons with a loaded pistol in one hand and a sword within reach is one of our faith's most treasured memories of this time. Yes, we have much to be proud of in the historical fight for the freedom of people held in slavery in this country, but it's not quite that simple, right? For it was one of our own also, President Willard Fillmore, a Unitarian, who signed the Fugitive Slave Act into law. Our spiritual ancestors were on all sides of the issue of slavery. While Parker was not alone in his radical denouncement of slavery and his proud disobedience to a law which he deemed unjust, while many other prominent abolitionists were Unitarians and Universalists, there were many whose own financial interests were so tied up in the slave trade that they were very reluctant to oppose it. And there were many who favored a much more gradual end to slavery, so to disrupt the economic order as little as possible and to offer some compensation to those who invested their money in the purchase of people, not to the people themselves. Many Unitarian voices were arguing that slavery was good for all people, or even that it was pleasing to black people. In the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act, Orville Dewey declared that personal rights and freedoms should be sacrificed by slaves for the greater good, and some suffering was for the betterment of all. And Richard Dennis Arnold, mayor of Savannah, Georgia, and a Unitarian, went so far as to write, this one is hard for me to read, "Servitude is happiness to the Negro. Liberty is a means to happiness to the Anglo-Saxon, and the present relative condition of both races is the best security for the prosperity and well-being of the whole community. It has worked well and would have worked well forever if left alone." It's chilling, right? What captures my attention most, though, from this period of our history is our gradual shifts. Not that we had people on both extremes, because of course people were products of their time. But what strikes me as most interesting is that we had people in between, grappling, really delving into the meat of this issue and writing about that. Some of our people were open to being personally transformed and then transforming the world as well. The story of this that stands out most for me is that of William Ellery Channing. Channing served the Federal Street Church in Boston, which would later become the Arlington Street Church, a place that I have at times called my spiritual home when living in Boston. Federal Street Church was full of the Boston elite, men who had their interests greatly intertwined with the slave trade, yes, even in Boston. As their minister and as a product of his time, like all were, Channing was reluctant to grapple with the issue of slavery for a good portion of his ministry. Given the significant influence of his pulpit over those in power, he was courted by many abolitionists to speak out against slavery. Channing was intrigued by Unitarian Lydia Maria Child's 1833 book, An Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans, in which she wrote, "In a community where all labor is done by one class, there must of course be another class who live in indolence. And we all know how much people that have nothing to do are tempted by what the world calls pleasures. The result is that slaveholding states and colonies are proverbial for dissipation, hence to the contempt for industry which prevails in such a state of society. Where none work but slaves, usefulness becomes degradation." Here we see the seeds for a strong argument for why slavery was not just destructive for those in bondage. When Channing did begin to speak out against slavery, he argued that it was a poisonous system that did not just harm those held within it, but harmed those who held them as well. And in this way, he was able to reach out both prophetically and pastorally to his congregation and urge them to free themselves as well from the bondage of their involvement in the slave trade. This sentiment was not his alone, and he was clearly influenced by many who had realized that by denying the freedom of another, we also forfeit our own. In 1844, Unitarian minister Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote that with slavery, everything goes to decay. In 1846, Unitarian minister Thomas Wentworth Higginson wrote and published a hymn that started, "There is no liberty for them who make their brethren slaves." And in 1866, African-American writer and activist Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who was a member of both Unitarian and AME churches, wrote, "We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity, and society cannot trample on the weakest and feeblest of its members without receiving the curse in its own soul. You tried that in the case of the Negro. You passed him down for centuries, and in so doing, you crippled the moral strength and paralyzed the spiritual energies of the white men in this country, too. We are all bound together in one great bundle of humanity." As we heard, Martin Luther King Jr. called this the network of mutuality. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are all poisoned by the injustices that we are complicit in. In fact, we are not free if any of our siblings in the universal family are held in bondage. Yet we know that there are those who struggle for their freedom. We know that the abolition of slavery did not end the institution altogether, and it certainly didn't end racism. We know that the fight for freedom and equity for people of color continues in this land to this day and will probably continue for some time. It's easy for us to look back and judge those who say, who stood by and did nothing because slavery didn't seem to affect them personally in any negative way or because they profited from it. But in truth, many of us today profit from a new form of slavery. In the documentary film 13th by Ava DuVernay, there's a clear line drawn between the 13th Amendment, which specifically states that no person should be held in slavery unless convicted of a crime, and the systemic criminalization of black people stemming from immediately after the abolition of slavery and gaining steam through policies that specifically target people of color in aggressive ways. Through the militarization of police, the war on drugs, and the targeting of communities of color, the disparities in mandatory minimums, the privatization of prisons, and the involvement in the corporate world in legislation designed to increase the profits made by the prison industrial complex, we've created a system of modern-day slavery that is perhaps even more pernicious. And in more recent years, it has come to light that many of these policies were intended to be racist from the very beginning. Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, writes that we are caught in a cyclical rebirth of caste in America that is a recurring racial nightmare. She notes that there are more African Americans under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, the year the Fugitive Slave Act was signed into law, a decade before the Civil War. As of 2004, she writes, more African American men were disenfranchised due to felon disenfranchisement laws than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly denied the right to vote on the basis of race. While crime rates are at historical lows, the rates of imprisonment have soared, quadrupled, actually. And the vast majority of the increase, she argues, is due to the war on drugs, a war waged almost exclusively in poor communities, even though statistics show that people of all colors use and sell illegal drugs at similar rates. In fact, she says some studies indicate that white youth are significantly more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. And we know that drug offenders in our prisons are overwhelmingly people of color, and that the people in our prisons are overwhelmingly nonviolent drug offenders. The private prison system is modern-day slavery, holding people of color in bondage, stripping them of their rights. Incarcerated people often work, being paid no more than a dollar per hour while they are incarcerated. And if all this is true, then none of us are free. If this is true, then our whole society is being poisoned by the systemic oppression of our fellow Americans. And from the four experiences that I have had inside jails or prisons in this country, whether as a visitor or a prisoner, I believe this to be true. When I followed in the footsteps of our spiritual ancestors, like Theodore Parker, by engaging in civil disobedience for the second time, protesting a law created by the prison industrial complex to allow racial profiling in order to increase profits for their prisons, I spent about a day and a half in the 4th Street Jail in Phoenix, Arizona, which was one of Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jails, if you've heard of him. There, I truly saw what Michelle Alexander and others describe with my own eyes. Now, while the full story of my experience will have to wait for another day, I must tell you that I believe strongly in how broken the system is. It's built on dehumanizing tactics, and it's severely problematic. Though it was felt most viscerally on my visit to the 4th Street Jail, each time I visited a jail or a prison, I've learned more about how we systematically dehumanize the people within the walls and within the system, how we create a culture that feeds recidivism, how we do not treat mental illness or drug addiction or even physical illness adequately. Adam Gopnik tackled this topic in The New Yorker in 2012 with his article, The Caging of America, Why We Lock Up So Many People. He tells that the 6 million people who are currently under correctional supervision in the U.S. are more than in the Gulag archipelago under Stalin at its height, and are given sentences much longer than are given for similar crimes anywhere else in the world. Between 1980 and 2010, the number of people incarcerated in relation to the population of the U.S. has more than tripled. In the past two decades, the money that states spend on prisons has risen at the rate of 6 times that of spending on higher education. And he notes that black people are incarcerated 7 times as often as white people. 7 times. without even getting into the horrid conditions in most prisons, and that privately owned prisons make more money as profit the more they save on feeding and clothing and taking care of the people they are supposedly taking care of, the system is clearly institutionalized racism. Gopnik writes, "No one who has been inside a prison, if only for a day, can ever forget the feeling. Time stops. A note of accentuated panic, of watchful paranoia, anxiety and boredom and fear mixed into a new kind of enveloping fog, covering the guards as well as the guarded. Yes, the guards are doing time too. In fact, we're all doing time. We're all complicit in the system that is out of control. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that kind of mass injustice is not something that I can stand by idly and watch. When we lock up so much of a whole population of people, when we discriminate so clearly based on race, none of us are free. My freedom, my liberation depends on all of your freedom and everyone's freedom." Now, I don't presume to have all the answers to this massive problem, or at least the time to lay any of them out here for you today. But imagine what might happen if we treated mental illness and drug addiction rather than criminalizing it. Imagine if we built houses of reform and redemption instead of houses of correction, places full of light and social workers and the promise of a better life. Imagine what could be possible if we acted as if redemption was possible and showed people that we believed in their worth and not that they were defined by their mistakes. Programs like this have worked wonders in other parts of the world. However we handle the problem, what we are doing is poisoning us all. And furthermore, it isn't working. And I believe that we, as people full of promise, as a nation built on the ideal of freedom and equality, we can do better. We must do better. Even knowing that I had lawyers already fighting for my release and being surrounded by other Unitarian Universalist activist women, it took me a few days to feel human again after being released from the 4th Street Jail. It took me a few days to feel human again. Because everything inside that system is designed to strip away your humanity. We have to find ways around the mass dehumanization of people, of all people. For in dehumanizing people, we as a society dehumanize ourselves. Let me repeat the words of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper of 1866. I love these words. "We are all bound up together in one big bundle of humanity, and society cannot trample on the weakest and feeblest of its members without receiving the curse in its own soul." If we are to learn the lessons of history, we have to learn how to put the humanity of people before our economy. We have to learn to uproot the racism that continues to find new legal ways to flourish. We have to stop letting capitalism's pernicious need to crush human life for the sake of profit from poisoning us all. We have to find another solution. Let us dismantle a system that threatens all of our freedom. Let us continue our journey towards a beloved community of all souls where all are free. Let us sing of liberation, knowing that until all are free, none are. May it be so, and amen.